Welcome back to the Mining Pod. We have another immersion mining takeover. This time we are joined by Austin Storms of Galaxy Digital. We go through Austin's first gateway into Bitcoin mining and how he is helping to co-run the facility down outside Lubbock, Texas with Galaxy Digital. It's the largest immersion mining facility in North America, so it's quite the task. It's a great conversation between Mark Taylor and Austin, so be sure to check it out. Also, some notes. We do have a new newsletter, which I'm pushing pretty hard. Please go subscribe to it. You can find it in today's show notes. It's blockspace.media. Just a quick form, and then you'll get the best news in Bitcoin and Bitcoin mining directly to your inbox twice per week. It's short. It's concise. It's great information, so go subscribe there. Second, we have a video coming out with Galaxy Digital in January, a short film, honestly. It's about 30 minutes long, detailing this Bitcoin mining facility that Austin is talking about in this very podcast. So be on the lookout for that. It'll be coming out in January. Thanks for taking a listen to the show. First, a word from our sponsor for this episode, Forman Mining. Hey, listeners. Let's talk about revolutionizing your mining operation with Forman. This isn't your average management tool. It's an all-in-one solution for reducing costs and significantly boosting your revenue. Forman brings a cutting-edge dashboard to your fingertips, empowering you with automated energy strategies. This means not only curtailing around real-time prices, but also strategically enhancing your profit margins through demand response. It's about leveraging energy efficiency to its fullest potential. With Forman, you get a system that scales with your business. Inventory management for assets, infrastructure integration, and business intelligence. Forman elevates the cash flow and production of your entire operation. To see how Forman can redefine your mining operation standards, visit Forman.mn. With Forman, you're not just managing a mining operation, you're setting a new standard.
All right, welcome back to the Mining Pod. Today we've got a fantastic guest. His name is Austin Storms of Galaxy Mining. Austin runs one of the biggest, if not the largest, immersion data centers in the world. Today's going to be here to share some of those experiences with us. So Austin, welcome to the Mining Pod.
Yeah, thanks, Taylor. Good to be here.
Yeah, no, thank you for coming. Definitely excited to have you on the show. We're going to start off with like some generic questions just to get to know you, and then we're going to dive into some technical nuances around immersion cooling and just mining in general. So can you tell us a little bit about who is Austin Storms and maybe what you did before Bitcoin?
Yeah, man. So look, it's a weird journey. Graduated from school in 2013 and worked for an offshore oil and gas company in the Gulf of Mexico for about a year. And then I went to work for Garmin International, big GPS company in Kansas City, Missouri, for like 2 years. Ran a lot of their marine survey team, multi-beam sonar, like bathymetric collection systems, hardware software integrations there. And then 2 years after I was at Garmin, spent some time in Lexington, Kentucky for a software development firm on a private contract with the state there, building out some of their ADFS infrastructure on their identity access management systems, and then jumped right into Bitcoin shortly after that. So
that leads into the next question. What was your orange pill moment that led you here?
Ha, it's a good one. Orange pill moment that got me into Bitcoin mining, I guess full time. So I was living in California. A friend of my dad's called me and he's like, hey, you know, want you to come home for Mardi Gras this year and ride in some parades and like hang out, invite a friend of yours. And the night before we were doing the biggest parade, it's called Endymion. We went over to his house and, you know, he starts asking me about what I know about Bitcoin and Ethereum. And this guy's, you know, he's a doctor. He's not a technologist kind of like we are. And at that point in time, I was like, holy cow, this thing's, you know, it's really starting to take off mainstream. Maybe I should delve a little bit deeper into it. And so really went down the rabbit hole early 2017 and have been almost full time since then. So
you now operate, you know, one of the largest immersion, you know, mines in the country, if not the world. But, you know, there was a path to get there. So it sounds like 2017, you really jumped in. Can you talk to us a little bit about your career, kind of where you started and what led you to your position over at Galaxy?
Yeah, for sure. So look, in 2017, I built a small half a megawatt facility in one of my dad's buildings, like right outside of New Orleans, totally air cooled, like S9s, early batch L3s, like some Dash miners, like the first ASICs that Bitcoin put out for Dash. And, you know, at that point in time, I was like, running on a utility tariff that was somewhere in between like 5 and 6 cent range, and market collapsed, late 2017, early 2018. And I realized, holy cow, like you've got to be like right next to stranded energy, whether it's, you know, excess wind or excess solar or some of these hydroelectric facilities that, you know, have a ton of potential, but don't have the transmission capacity to move the power from where the dam is to where the load centers are. And spun out of that like little joint venture and started a company called Bearbox, and designed hardware like containerized mining solutions early 2018 that you can move anywhere in the world, and plug and play on site, like 208 three phase electrical. Again, like back then it's all S9s, and there's I had a bunch of Dragomint T1s, which were not the best machines. And then had some like early testing with Brains OS when they first put it out in 2019. And then Marty Bent called me from Great American Mining. I guess this was late 2019, early 2020, when they were first like kicking off some of their early flare gas stuff in North Dakota. And he's like, hey, we need somebody who's like hardware, understands containerized systems. I put some of the Bearbox stuff on Twitter, and went to go work for Great American Mining, and then became the director of engineering there. Oversaw all the engineering and operations. We had a manufacturing facility where we built everything from the ground up, power distribution units, custom built, deployed in North Dakota. The first deployment we ever did was like negative 45 degrees. Probably the coldest I've ever been in my life. And then was at Great American Mining for about 2 years. And then Amanda Fabiano called me and said, hey, we're really dialing up some of the, you know, proprietary mining operations at Galaxy. And I need an engineer. I need an operator. And so since then I've been at Galaxy, and it's been just that 2 years now.
Just out of curiosity, when your early days of mining, and you said essentially a utility closet or no utility rate, sorry, not utility closet, what were you using to cool the miners? I mean, I'm assuming air cooled, but like, what was the setup kind of like early on? Because it's always cool to think back of like what you thought would work.
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. So the first facility that I built, the half megawatt facility, it was in an end suite at one of my dad's existing buildings, and the suite itself was like 1,200 square feet. I put, you know, machines down the center aisle, blowing into like hot aisles, and then exhausting them through the front of the building, like in these small windows that were cut out. The first Bearbox container, it had a Permatron Model U like pre-filter on the outside with a like a welded piano hinge overhang. Looks kind of like a makeshift weather hood. And then I had what's the name of the company? It's like J&D Manufacturing, like big 36 inch exhaust fans that we welded into the side of the container into its own frame. And so single air pass through, not great filtration back in the day. The S9s could take a beating, the Dragomints not so much. But yeah, just it was all air cooled until I got to Galaxy. Everything was air cooled. Yeah.
Man, well, that's really interesting to hear about your past. I mean, it sounds like you've really covered every gamut of mining from building your own hardware and obviously operating large facilities. I did want to touch on Dragomint. You know, it sounds like you were lucky enough to meet and interact with Yoshi. How many of those machines did you actually get in and deploy? Those were quite the topic back in 2017 and 18.
Yeah. So I think we bought somewhere north of like 200 of them at $2,000 a unit. And you know, at the time, those were like 16 to 18 terahash. And so really, really expensive on a dollar per terahash basis. And not the best machines I've ever run. Unfortunately, like the power supplies weren't great, and the hashing boards themselves weren't phenomenal. But ran them until they died. And yeah, that was. I don't know if I'd buy Dragomint T1s if I had a time machine again.
Yeah, no, his marketing was definitely pretty interesting. He'd come around with his German employee, and they'd turn on the one machine and show it to you, and you'd order them. I always found that really interesting. I met with him in Dallas in 2017, and I'll definitely never forget it. But yeah, going through, I mean, you've touched on really everything. You know, I guess this is a good time to transition into Galaxy. Can you give us a download on, you know, what your position is and what you're doing day to day? And then we'll dive into some of the immersion after that.
Yeah, for sure. So my position at Galaxy, I am I'm technically co-head of our mining business unit. So within the business unit, it's myself and Brian Wright. Brian does a phenomenal job on basically all things on the business side. And then I'm in charge and run point on all operations, engineering, and power. So Galaxy's mining operations, the proprietary ones, we operate in ERCOT primarily and really only at this point. And, you know, as you guys both know, ERCOT is a wild market for power. And looking at a mining operation that's fully integrated there requires like a holistic view and a 30,000 foot view on operations and engineering and power, so you can orchestrate everything kind of in conjunction. But that's what I do at Galaxy now. We've got one big facility that we acquired from Argo last year at the Helios facility. And then we have a smaller facility in East Texas, both of which are immersion based, but they're two different systems.
Did you have any influence on going immersion, or is that pretty much the path Galaxy wanted to make prior?
Yeah, so the decision to do the East Texas facility as immersion instead of air cooled was you know, it was a team decision, but I kind of led that entirely. Looking at some of the offerings for off the shelf infrastructure, I guess this was last April or May. There weren't any great air cooled offerings back then that I thought that I could reliably deploy as our first project, like really diving into the deep end of prop mining. And so I kind of, for a lack of better terms, like spearheaded the immersion based approach to our East Texas facility. And then, you know, we adopted the immersion facility, that's currently running at Helios as part of that acquisition.
Was there any thought of doing air cooled there? As many people will probably know, doing an air cooled farm in Texas in the summer can be done, but it is quite tricky. Was that one of the main reasons why you wanted to go immersion?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So, you know, kind of stepping back into the time machine of, you know, April or May of last year when we kicked off that project, we looked at it as two main benefits to immersion. Number one, I knew I could control the operating environment. And then number two, I knew it would operate in Texas, where I hadn't previously operated an air-cooled machine or any air-cooled infrastructure. And so immersion was a little bit of a leap of faith, but really knew on a dollar per terahash basis, the overclock would get us somewhere in the range of 15 to 20% of free terahashes, as you might call them. And then, you know, I was more confident operating immersion infrastructure in Texas than I was air cooled, given my experiences.
No, and then in diving more into that, you know, you said you operate a few different systems. Are these systems that you guys have designed? Are these systems that you've bought from an immersion provider, single phase, two phase, oil to water, oil to oil? Can you provide some details on the systems that you guys are operating in Texas?
Yeah, for sure. So let's start, I guess, with the East Texas facility. It is dual loop and off the shelf purchased the Midas immersion facilities or immersion solution. The Midas solution was fantastic. We actually worked with an outside engineering firm out of Austin, Texas, to upgrade some of the things just to like double, triple check that we're going to get the heat rejection capacity that we wanted, and then we effectively designed the building itself from the ground up, and the internal HVAC was designed by me. I built like the low voltage control systems for the VFDs, for the cabinet fans, and then did, you know, all of the networking and everything else that runs that facility. Looking at that one, I think Taylor, you're familiar with those systems. Like we have, you know, you've got the water loop with the big pump skid, and you've got the individual heat exchangers under the tanks. There's just trade-offs, I think, in engineering. Like that system's dual loop. You know, there are minor oil leaks here or there, minor water leaks in the CPVC headers here or there. But all in all, like really, really like that build. And then the Helios facility, like Mark, you're super familiar with it. It is single loop immersion, so no water whatsoever. Pumping Spectrason 2B through the dry coolers and right back into the tanks through big carbon steel headers. Totally different system. Totally different challenges and constraints. But yeah, it's fun. It's fun, and it's the experience in running both of those things, I think, is something that I might have as like at a scale that other people just don't at this point.
Here's a question for you. In your dual loop, do you have glycol in your
So, and I know why you're asking this. No, I don't have any glycol mix. We've looked at it in the summer, like the heat rejection capacity from adding like a 15 to 20% glycol mix really ruins the heat rejection of those big like 2.5 megawatt Gutner towers. In the wintertime, because I'm in East Texas, I like the hard freeze chance, like taking 2021 and Winter Storm Uri totally out of the system and out of the equation and out of like the back test is pretty low. We have a strategy for, you know, any type of weather forecast that looks like we're going to have a hard freeze, but I'm not running any glycol in the systems. No.
And you do have, you know, some unique experience operating both, right? You know, the two loop system using water, if you have the right final heat rejection, gives you a lot of flexibility on temperatures. You know, the oil to oil is obviously utilizing zero water, some, you know, less components, things like that. If you really had to choose and you're going to build your next site, or, you know, just kind of take insight from your experience, you know, which way would you go? Would you do water to oil, or would you stick with oil to oil? What would you advise the viewers of is a better way forward?
Yeah. It's a really good question. I don't know. Like there's just trade-offs in the engineering phase. Like if I'm building in Texas, I'm probably gonna go single loop oil with adiabatics on the intake of the dry coolers. If I'm building somewhere else, like say I'm building in North Dakota, I'm gonna go oil to oil, like single loop system, no heat exchangers, right into the miners with probably no adiabatics on that system. I like the simplicity of the single loops, but they do present some challenges in the summer without adiabatic cooling assistance.
Yeah, I mean, you're operating in one of the worst environments in Texas, right? In the middle of the summer, you kind of need that water assistance, right? So when you're doing this, like you have a lot of experience, you've used all the different types of cooling as far as single phase. What are some of the common issues you see with people building, you know, immersion farms? We've all seen on the Telegram and the Twitter threads and everything, you know, the disaster stories, X, Y, and Z. But obviously, you know, you're operating a very successful business over at Galaxy, you know, using immersion cooling, CleanSpark's using immersion cooling. It's been going really well for us. You know, what are the common issues you see both, you know, we'll call them the pleb miners or the public miners? What issues and what kind of reoccurring themes are you seeing people doing?
Issues with immersion cooling. I think the biggest issue that I've seen so far is that most people underestimate the radiant heat load from tanks in like a container or in a building. That's exactly it, Mark. I think there, like you have to be able to run a legitimate computational fluid dynamics model for inside of the building, even if you're ejecting the majority of the heat through the oil itself in a dry cooler. I've seen that time and time again, where people think like dry cooler and oil, it's this magic bullet. And then you stand over a tank and the tank is, you know, 130 or 140 degrees, and you don't take into account the heating effect there. And so that's a big one. In addition to that, like cleaning up any type of spills, you know, the Spectrum 2 series, any spills from that, you spill a gallon of it and it covers like 1,000 square feet. And there's no way around that when you're running an immersion facility, but being preemptive in containing those spills and then cleaning them up, I think a lot of people just don't think through the operations of those facilities going forward.
Yeah, and I think it's also interesting, a lot of the tank providers don't put lids on the tank, so the heat literally is just radiating out with nothing to stop it. And then you essentially create a hot box where the heat is therefore drawn back into the oil. Miners start to overheat, and yeah, it's definitely not a good time at all.
And also safety wise, I mean, I don't know if you guys had had a slip and fall in some Spectrason 2C or any other immersion oil, but they are like the slipperiest stuff on the planet. And yeah, like, you know, you drop a gallon, that gallon is going many feet in all directions.
Yeah, exactly. And those are the things like operationally, you know, and I think this is really important in software development. Like your DevOps teams really span the development lifecycle and span the ongoing operations and maintenance of whatever stood up. I think a lot of folks, when they're designing immersion facilities, they design them from an engineering perspective. The blueprint is fantastic, but then you don't think about the ongoing operations, the preventative maintenance of the pumps and the heat exchangers and every other component that's in the fluid mechanical system, and who's gonna do the operations and whether they're trained or not. And so like taking a holistic approach to engineering and ops is something I've kind of always done. And I think the plebs, you know, there's just like channels and channels and posts about, you know, people designing something that's supposed to work perfectly and then not understanding like, hey, we actually have to maintain this equipment going forward. Like these are motors and these are impellers. Like it's a real, real operating entity.
Yeah, I mean, I think you really need to look at your immersion farm as almost like a product and have a product manager that's housing it from start to finish. Because I've heard horror stories on the heat rejection side, right? But then people don't get into the nuances of the operations, like Mark bringing up spilled oil, right, at CleanSpark. And at TMG, we've got special mats all over the floors, right? We have walking paths and things like that. But it comes all the way down to the details of, like, when I was at TMG, I saw videos of people reaching into oil. Like, why don't you have handles? Like, it's just all the little things that people don't really think through. About how they're going to drain the oil out and all that kind of stuff that really kind of sets people back. One more question before we move off this. You've mentioned the specific oil, you know, several times. Is that something that, you know, you chose? Is it industry standard? You know, talk to us a little bit about your selection of oil, because I think that's somewhere where a lot of people take the wrong step by using transformer oil, mineral oil, or just something that doesn't have a lot of megawatt hours behind it. The miners start to fail and then they blame immersion. So talk to me a little bit about why you're using your specific oil.
Yeah, that's a really good question. So prior to joining Galaxy, when I was at Great American Mining, we did some small immersion testing when I was there. And I looked at the materials compatibilities list. Principal engineer at the time was Reet Browning, who's currently the CTO at Cathedra. And Reet and I were like, okay, let's try BitCool 888 from Gary Testa. Let's check that out. And then let's find a more economically feasible alternative. Then when I left and I went to Galaxy, the first facility that we built, the East Texas site, That was oil that was provided by the Midas team under their kind of like turnkey solution. And then upon acquisition of Helios, the oil that was there was the oil that was there. And so they were already, we'd already procured the Exxon fluid. But really it's like, you know, Gary Test at Engineered Fluids has a fantastic materials compatibilities list and a minor compatibility list with all of their different oils. Exxon did similar testing. And those things like the little nuances between transformer oil or like mineral. I've seen people put miners in mineral oil before. It just destroys some of the components on the PCB. And so as you're testing these things at home or as you're testing them in a commercial or industrial environment, like materials compatibility is everything. Otherwise your investment's ruined. You're not cash flowing. And that is, yeah, it's something that we look deeply into on the engineering side. And I kind of just brought that intellectual capital with me to Galaxy.
One thing I wanted to touch on, if you could talk about it, because I know there's not a ton of public photos of the inside of Helios. Can you talk about the pros and cons of having, it by far has to be the highest density immersion farm. I mean, from what I recall, it's 3 football fields long and it's 200 megawatts under one roof, which is pretty insane.
Yeah, what's the watts per square footage of that facility? It's got to be pretty up there.
It's pretty high, yeah. So look, I the Helios facility, so Alex Thorne actually was at the facility a couple weeks ago during the solar eclipse event in Texas, and he took some videos and he just posted one on Twitter of the inside of the facility that shows like the bottom level of tanks and the top level of tanks and the power distribution units mounted on the racks there. It's super dense. Like We've got like a whole bottom level in the facility and a whole top level in the facility on different immersion headers back to the dry coolers and totally different like discretized fluid mechanical systems. I'm not gonna lie, it's a pain to service machines that are in top tanks. And when I say like top level of tanks, like the guys are on genie lifts, 12 feet in the air servicing machines in that single loop system. And it's not as easy. The East Texas site is like single level, all of the piping's on grade. It's really pretty simple. I remember, a couple of months ago when I took some of the Helios team out to the East Texas facility to help deploy machines there, they were just astounded by how much easier it was to deploy on a single level than deploy on the dual level system that's at Helios. It is super, super dense. Like from a, I think the existing white space or data center space at Helios is 100,000 square feet, somewhere in that range. So, 200 megawatts over 100,000 square feet, like you can do the math. It's a lot of power under one roof for sure.
And while the miners, might be hard to service at the top, can you talk to the viewers a little bit about service intervals between an air-cooled miner and an immersion-cooled machine?
Whew, service intervals, yeah. So this is one of my favorite things about like the operating expense changes between an air-cooled facility and an immersion facility. So in an air-cooled facility, not only do you have like excessive amounts of intake filter changes, but you also like invariably there's dust that gets through the system or there's other particulate matter that kind of builds up on the hashing boards and builds up on the heat sinks. And so when I was at Great American Mining and even before at Bearbox and kind of when I was doing my own thing, I was running, I think it was like 60-day maintenance cycles on machines, like compressor cleanouts, like unplug them, pull them off the racks, clean them out, put them back on the racks, just to maintain like free airflow across those heat sinks. Because as you guys both well know, the rejection capacity of an air-cooled machine has a direct effect, and even an immersion machine has a direct effect on its efficiency, the number of hashes that are able to produce, the chip temperatures. In the immersion builds, it's much less machine maintenance. It's much more mechanical systems maintenance. And so we have a mechanical team at Helios. That's a four-man team led by a guy named Brent Farmer, who they do like all pump maintenance, all fan maintenance, all hose maintenance, ball valve replacements. They do everything in that system. But mostly when it's running, you've got your normal PMs. You've got 90-day PMs on heavy mechanical equipment and very, very little work on the miners, especially if they're new. Yeah.
What about oil filtration? I know that's a question that I've been wanting to ask a guest because I've seen some farms that do it. I've seen some farms that don't. I see some farms that should. What are your thoughts, especially with Spectrum 2C? I know different oils have different properties that react differently with different things. So I figure I ask.
Yeah. So on the filtration side, we have at Helios, we have a rolling AMSOL filter setup where we cycle fluid out of tanks in real time through the AMSOL filter back into the tanks. That facility is pretty clean these days. It wasn't super clean when we took it over, but we did some things that allowed us to keep dust out of there in West Texas. And so the team uses that sparingly now. In addition to that, like we do like annual dielectric tests of the fluid in the tanks and the fluid in the systems at Helios to make sure that there's no degradation there. At our East Texas site, like we don't do any filtration. Those are on a tank by tank basis, like Taylor, as you know. And that facility is pretty clean as well. And so I think same thing with an air cooled facility that has not great intake air handling, or is exposed to environmental variables like dust and bugs and other things like that. Like your facility design determines how often you need to filter the oil. And I know at Helios we do have Y strainers in line on some of those carbon steel header systems, and so it's actively filtered there, and then the team does go around and clean some things up in the event that we need to, but super, super rare occurrence.
So just wanted to follow, just continuing on that, do you see a future of immersion with Galaxy, or do you want to try something different? You know, maybe air, hydro, or do you want to, you know, expand on the immersion sites?
Yeah, really good question. So we're currently doing a expansion at the Helios facility that is air cooled. That's largely driven by like some of the material cost increases on the immersion side, and some of the active constraints that I had with the existing building there. I'm open to any and all. I think in Texas, cooled systems are, I think they need some work, given the hard nature of some of the water that you pull up from shallow wells or even deep wells. A lot of that's super brackish, but I'm open for anything. You know, we take a pretty holistic approach to making those type of capital decisions. We do extensive amount of financial modeling for like project level returns and IRRs, and we kind of weigh all of our options. But at the end of the day, I do like immersion the best because the operating expenses are lower than an air cooled facility. But you've got to look at a bunch of different variables there.
I think it would be pretty cool to look at, like to compare farms. Once it's more public about, what is it? Iris's Children's site, I think it's like 2 or 3 hours away, and they're the exact opposite. They're 100% air cooled. And I'm curious how that's going to end up doing in West Texas. Actually, I'm trying to think. Taylor, weren't we at like a Twitter space and we were hounding people about questions about air cooled in West Texas?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the one of the CEOs over at Iris is definitely an air cooled, you know, we'll call him Maxi up there with Steve. So yeah, definitely be interesting to see how the Galaxy farm compares to the Childress site for sure. You know, one thing I think is interesting, right? And Austin, you've been around for a long time. There was a lot of innovation in 2015, 2016, companies like Bitfury, you know, Canon, TMG, you know, building these rather, let's call them futuristic type immersion deployments, right? You know, through 2018 through now, we really haven't seen too much innovation until this last year with What's Miner actually building a machine for immersion, a little bit different design qualities than their air-cooled machine, and that gone really well. You know, Canon stepped into the forefront and is doing something similar. You know, what do you think the future of immersion is? Is it continuing to convert air-cooled boxes, or do you see a more integrated approach between the tanks and the miners, kind of like what we're seeing on the hydro side of things? Like, where do you think we're going now that we've had a bunch of crazy innovation, things have kind of died off into single phase, keeping it more standard? Do you think we'll see another run here in the next bull?
I think it depends. So as we look at some of the like immersion specific designs from Canon and MicroBT, those are fantastic. Now, do they at a project level, can you like get a decent like IRR, and can you meet whatever hurdle you have as like your cost of capital? TBD. I think a lot of these systems, whether it's immersion or whether it's hydro, like we looked at some of the early MicroBT heat core units and that partnership that they had. And I just didn't have enough testing data from them to like really dive in and allocate capital towards that solution. And so as we see like more and more advanced machines coming out, like I would expect I think I did a talk on this at Bitcoin Miami last year, like the reuse of heat from some of these systems and the recycling of like low grade waste heat is going to be more and more important. But TBD, like, do I want to convert, you know, air cooled S19s to like be immersion ready forever? Probably not. But if the capital expenditure makes sense to do that, then maybe. I think it's going to depend. Ideally, we have like a standard rack mount unit that goes into the immersion fluid with handles on it, like we've seen from some of the newer MicroBT units. And that should be the industry standard going forward. But again, it's like, what are the R&D costs? What's the return on capital look like? And does this make sense for my current setup, or do I need to retrofit things? There's so many questions still to be answered there.
Yeah, I mean, we've kind of gently stepped into the miner realm here. You know, is Galaxy an Antminer, what's miner, Canaan? What do you guys have deployed over there, and how are you interfacing with it? You know, we have Mark here, who's obviously deeply integrated in the firmware space. Would love to hear more about, you know, what you guys are running and how you're controlling it over at Galaxy, if you can share.
So I can share pretty high level. So we have Bitmain units and we have MicroBT units. I don't think we publicly disclose like our entire fleet efficiency, but we have both integration with them. We run various firmware, right? We run a bunch of different firmwares from a bunch of different third-party providers. We also run stock firmware on some of the Bitmain units, I think, that are in tanks now. We have like a few of them that probably still have fan spoofers on them from way back in the day. But it's a mixed bag of everything. Bitmain units, MicroBT units, all different models of Bitmain units, and then a couple different third-party firmware providers.
Which unit do you like the most, and why?
I'll
And you
say
can't say the S9 because, you know.
no, it's the S9 is like the AK-47 of ASICs, right? Like I wish I had a whole, you know, mountain of them. No, look, I think it was, what was it, a couple days ago, I was on site and we dunked S19 XP. And Mark, I actually reached out to you to get a firmware build for that machine. Really impressed with the results there. I think the standard S19J Pros are really, really flexible. And I think they provide a ton of optionality between underclocking and overclocking. But you know, looking at like my favorite machine, I think some of the S19 Pro 110 terahash units are the best performing by far. And I wish I truly had a mountain of those, because those are the best. No bars. Yeah.
No, and then you know, you say you're running multiple third-party firmware providers. What goes into the assessment of those? You know, I think that's the most widely asked question I get in my position is, hey, this about firmware, that about firmware. Why do you choose this one? Why do you choose that one? Can you walk us through some of your logic on how you like assess and evaluate these different third-party firmwares as they come to market?
Yeah, for sure. So when we look at, you know, I think there's really two, I would say two firmware providers that are above everybody else. BrainsOS Plus is fantastic, like their team a lot, and then the VanishOS or like ASIC.to firmware. When we decide on third-party firmware, we look at the commercial aspects, like what does the development fee look like, and then in addition to that, we look at firmware support, just like general firmware support from their team, their development team, ability to produce and deliver quickly. And you know, from an integrations perspective, I look at optionality within the firmware. I look at like how modular is it, what does it provide, like in terms of customization. You know, can I set like a global chain frequency across it? Are there, you know, preset tuning profiles? Does it have like chip by chip auto tuning? Does it integrate with Forman? Does it integrate with AwesomeMiner? Like what is the total industry and ecosystem support for those things? And so look, we take a pretty holistic approach to the engineering. For the systems, as well as like looking at, okay, what do I think I need to do for the existing fluid mechanical systems that are running at Helios or at the East Texas facility, and then we decide on firmware based on that.
Just off of curiosity, why do you think the manufacturers don't provide a miner with decent firmware out of the gate?
So it's really good question. I Look, Bitmain and MicroBT, they both make a fantastic product. I don't run any Canaan units, but they're not in the business of providing like open firmware for their machines. They're in the business for like building reliable hardware. And so I think from a manufacturer's perspective, if I'm looking at like where is my top line revenue driver? I don't think it's in providing firmware for the machines that I'm going to sell. at no change in cost, whether I provide firmware or not. And so that's my answer to that question.
No, but it's true though, because if you think about it, like they released the low power mode firmware for the 19 series, like 2 years after it's been out. You know, other farms have had that. And it's funny how they just offer it, you know, in that weird time span where they're waiting for the XP to come out. So we're like, oh, we'll improve your fleet efficiency for a little bit. And then buy the next machine. I mean, it makes sense. You know, they want you to keep buying and selling your old stuff. One question I wanted to go back on, it was an immersion question. It was in regards to, like, have you thought about two-phase, and then also like form factor, like OEM form factor, like we're seeing what Spiner's making and what Spiner designed immersion model.
Mm-hmm. So have I thought about two-phase? No. I have bigger fish to fry than kind of going down the rabbit hole of two-phase. I've looked at it previously. Not a huge fan of the phase conversion, and I think there are some potential challenges there. Mostly from a like health and safety perspective. For the micro BT, like OEM immersion specific units, I like them. Still haven't run one kind of to this day. But from what I've seen, they check a lot of the boxes that I think an industry move on the immersion side would require. Taylor, have you looked at the two-phase systems?
I mean, a majority of my career is in designing and operating two-phase systems. So yeah, definitely did a ton of work there. Yeah, some of the health and safety stuff that you do hear about is kind of a LARP that's been propagated by some of the single phase providers. I think I've got more working hours of round two phase fluid than anybody but Phil Tuma, and as you can see, I'm totally fine. So that'll be kind of interesting to divulge. It does have some environmental impacts, so there are people working on new fluids and things like that. So we won't go down that rabbit hole, but there's definitely some really interesting work to be done there in the future years. You know, we were talking about Texas, you know, we're talking about firmware. Is there any interest in you with like companies like Aerodyne and Chain Reaction that are offering machines with some of this, let's call it more highly developed firmware right out of the box? And, you know, Aerodyne's especially in that power market, and a lot of their marketing material has been made that way. Have you guys started exploring any of these kind of, let's call them alternative ASICs from our normal providers, Bitmain and What's Miner?
Yeah. So I guess the short answer to that is, like, yes, we've looked at a lot of things, but I can't divulge any specifics at this point in time.
Oh yeah, no, that makes sense. You don't want to break NDAs, right? So that makes sense. Then I guess moving forward, like more into the machines, right? So, you know, Bitmain continues to make immersion life a little bit difficult, right? So their new T21 series has a 380 to 415 volt input. You know, how hard is it for you if you wanted to update to those machines, say at Helios or your East Texas site, to make adjustments to accept that different voltage range from our, you know, standard 240 we've seen over the last 5 to 10 years?
Yeah. So to go, I think 380 to 415 on the power supply, like all that would involve is like repulling the low voltage feeder circuits at Helios to a delta system, and then redesigning PDUs. Not a huge lift there. I think more so is like the form factor of the machine and whether that fits in the existing tanks, or if I have to re-engineer the tank sizing. Same thing with our East Texas site. That site actually runs 277 480. And so again, like I would just have to repull feeder circuits to panel boards or PDUs, and then replace, you know, obviously the power cables to provide that electricity and that voltage as well.
I also think on the new gen stuff, they all have that new, what is the Anderson connection?
Is that the red and yellow and
there's like four wires inside the wire that like snap on? That's fun.
Yeah, we got some of those a couple years ago when I was at Great American Mining. We got a few of those on micro BT power supplies that we needed in the 277 input range, and it was a mountain of work because we weren't informed that they were shipping with that input on the PSU. And we had already pre-made the C19 to C20 cables. And so as they were getting delivered in North Dakota, we were cutting and butt splicing and heat shrinking existing power cables to provide that termination. I think you guys know as well as anybody else, the manufacturers, when they ship things, they don't always give you the perfect specifications. And so you've got to be pretty flexible and pretty nimble in the field to accommodate those.
In regards to, you know, the way manufacturers, you know, ship things and, you know, how it just arrives, have you had a chance to look at the hydros, and what are your thoughts on like the setup and design of that? And do you think that's something that could work in Texas, West Texas?
Yeah. So hydros in West Texas are, I think they're really tricky. And the reason being is there's not great fresh water in West Texas. And I think I alluded to it earlier on the call, like drilling a shallow well, 150 to 300 feet, like maybe you hit a decent aquifer and you're flowing through like a 6 to 10 inch casing, 150 to 300 GPM. And it's kind of clean and it's not super hard and it has a little bit of particulate matter. But as you look at like deeper wells, if you need a lot more water for some of these really large industrial sites, the water is very brackish. And then you've got to stand up on site like a full-on reverse osmosis system. And then the RO systems get really expensive and you have to maintain them. And so like the scope just continues to creep. You know, somebody told me a few years ago that the reason that Bitmain went so hard and heavy into the water-cooled or hydro-cooled units was because those were for the domestic Chinese market. And they had different like environmental impacts and different environmental like regulatory issues with like pulling and pass through and dumping back into some of the rivers. You just don't have that in West Texas. And so if you can solve the freshwater, low TDS, low calcification in those systems in West Texas, yes, but it's just expensive.
I think that's a really good point, and I think you're exactly right, because if you see the S21 launch this year, they're actually rebuilding the systems to work with dry coolers, so that way you're not consistently adding water. So I think that was a really valuable point that you just made, and I think the OEMs are starting to catch on, right? Because I believe the heat core unit itself is a dry cooler and not a cooling tower, right? So I think that'll help with adoption. You know, the tanks, you can put different miners in, put a Wetz miner next to an S19. How do you feel about the hydro units where you're kind of locked into whatever provider and that specific miner for that flow rate and tube placement, that kind of stuff? Is that something that you kind of want to steer away from, or benefit of immersion, or how do you feel about that?
Yeah, it's you guys are asking all the really good questions today. I think for some of the current hydro cooled offerings, you are a bit of a captive customer to the OEM for any and all controls on that system. As we look at optionality at both our East Texas facility and the Helios facility, there are ways that I can retrofit the existing fluid mechanical systems to accommodate some of those things. But you know, not having the optionality to have a, you know, dielectric tank with, you know, a micro BT unit next to a Bitmain unit and not having the, really it's the flexibility to go out and procure miners at any price, regardless of form factor. That's a trade-off that I'm not sure if I'm willing to make yet, but TBD on it, yeah.
No, it's definitely something, you know, we're looking at is, you know, you lock in offerings, you want to build infrastructure for 10 years, you know, it's definitely something you got to keep in mind. Mark, something you were going to add?
Yeah, I was going to say immersion versus water blocks. Which side are you on?
When you say water blocks, you mean like direct to chip cooling?
Yeah, like a hydro. Like there's a heat sink with a water block.
From an engineering perspective, the heat rejection capacity of water is higher than any of the dielectrics that we use. So it's probably better. But from a, I remember the first time I saw one of the Bitmain, the Ampbox hydro units, and you know, the 10,000 little poly tubes in that build, I was with Mike Hamilton from Grid, and I was like, Mike, would you ever run this? And he's like, no, absolutely not. Like that operationally, it looks a bit like a nightmare. And so I think, you know, as that side of the industry matures on the hydro cooling, like direct to chip cooling with water, maybe, but it's got to be something that can be operated reliably going forward. Otherwise, like, things start to break and you just can't fix them.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people forget that there was an S9 hydro that never really got a lot of traction, right? When you look at hydro versus immersion adoptions, I think we're into the gigawatts for immersion and maybe into 50 or 100 megawatts on the hydro, which I think speaks a lot for itself. You know, working at a publicly traded company, you have to be very careful about the technologies you choose. And to your point earlier, Austin, there's a lot of megawatt hours behind immersion in oil versus not a lot of megawatt hours versus data, you know, behind the hydro cooling, at least for our industry. Understood it's highly accepted in the data center space, but would definitely like to see it progress a lot more before we get too interested in it, right?
Exactly correct. Look, every decision that I make and, you know, that the team at Galaxy makes, we have to, it's almost like we have to have capital assurances, and we've got to have like real field data to analyze and to kind of back the thesis on where we're spending dollars. And so, you know, I mentioned it earlier, like we looked at some of the earliest micro BT and kind of heat core four post rack mount units. Those were direct hydro to board cooled units. And I just didn't have the data to feel comfortable making that decision. And so we didn't do it. But, you know, I've seen that offering and it's matured a little bit since I first saw it, and would be happy to kind of dip our toes in it at this point.
Oh, yeah, for sure. You know, one thing as we get to the end of the show, I really wanted to touch on is, you know, Galaxy isn't just a mining company, right? Obviously, Galaxy is multifaceted. Is there any benefits or kind of drawbacks of being multifaceted in the sense of obviously you're getting a lot of intel from the crypto community, the investment community, you have a huge mining arm. Talk to us a little bit about working at Galaxy and what kind of benefits that has.
Yeah. So look, we kind of span a bunch of different offerings across the entire crypto industry. I was just in New York a few weeks ago working with our strategic operations team. They're doing some really interesting stuff on the staking side of the industry. You know, David Wise, who's our head of blockchain infrastructure, was with me this week at Helios. And we you know, some of the breadth and depth of knowledge across Galaxy for the industry, like crypto industry as a whole, is really, really helpful. You know, we've got an asset management team that's really fantastic. We've got a trading team, we've got a lending team. You know, in addition to that, we've got a venture team that's led by Will Nelly. And so, and we've got a full like investment banking team that goes out and raises money for people. And so I think like at the end of the day, being close to all of those different business units within Galaxy gives you more like a more holistic view, kind of into the industry as a whole, into our peers as a whole. And no, it's a well-rounded firm. And I think, you know, those businesses, as they're led by really, really smart people, they are accretive to other businesses under the Galaxy umbrella.
And when you're talking about scale and like sizing, right? Like you have all these different teams, how big is the mining operation maybe in people of Galaxy?
Yeah, another really good question. So we have like the core mining team, and I say core mining team, like the folks that we had on mining before we acquired the Helios facility. And I think right now we've got like somewhere around 10 or 12 folks on that team. And then the Helios facility, we've got like another 35 people that we directly employ in Dickens County. And that's like on-site operations team, electrical, mechanical, data center team, you know, that we've got an optimization lead out there who his only job now is to go find things that we can improve upon across the entire campus. We've got a facilities team. And so looking at Galaxy Mining kind of as a whole, it's right around 50 people. Yeah.
So you have 200 megawatts operated by 35 people.
So I would say it's 200 megawatts of infrastructure, like at the electrical substation through and through, like, you know, medium voltage feeder circuits and low voltage systems, not quite 200 megawatts operational, today, but yeah, that is, you know, the Helios facility is roughly, 200 megawatts of operational capacity. And then the East Texas site, which I, you know, I, I kind of joke about this internally at Galaxy, like our East Texas facility is 16 megawatts, and we actually have 0 employees at that facility. Because it is, fully immersion, and we do our preventative maintenance schedules every 60 to 90 days, and nothing really breaks, which fingers crossed. Last time I said that, I ended up driving 3 hours to go restart a pump. But no, it's that's and that's one of the reasons too I alluded to earlier, like the operating expenses. If you design immersion correctly, there aren't that many operating expenses outside of just regular preventative maintenance.
And do you guys write your own farm management software, or use Foreman or AssetMiner? How do you guys handle all your remote access?
Yeah, it's a good question too. We have a mix. So, we've got a couple different miner management systems that we use, for different things. We've got an AssetMiner integration. We've got a Foreman integration. I've been testing out the new like Vanish toolkit. Am I allowed to say that, Mark? Is that like public yet?
Yeah, it works.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have to. It's been good.
It's been good. Look, it's much better than like previously. I think we were pushing firmware updates using BTC tools, which is really tough. And so it's proven to be much better on that front. But yeah, we have integrations with the existing like what I would call the major apparatus miner management systems. And then we also have like proprietary software that runs against fluid mechanical system PLCs, the ERCOT market integration that we wrote in-house. Yep.
Do you plan on doing any of it in-house?
Do we plan on doing any of it in-house? Yeah, we did. Look, so part of my background is like on the power systems integration side. One of the first things I did when I joined Galaxy was, hire a former power markets engineer. Well, he is a power markets engineer on our team, but he was a transmission power systems modeler at ERCOT prior. His name is Blake King, and we have deep subject matter expertise within ERCOT. And so part of our entire thesis on the East Texas development, and then also in the acquisition of Helios, was that we had the context and the deep knowledge in that vertical to build a lot of those integrations in-house.
And then a question I asked our last guest, and this is, you take this however you want to take it, and I'm going to totally read this right off my notes. What personal professional lessons have you learned from your experience in the cryptocurrency mining industry that you'd like to share? And this could be however you want to take that.
I think two big ones. First, not your keys, not your coins. We've seen time and time again, and I think SBF just got found guilty on all of his fraud charges yesterday. Like we've seen time and time again, like rampant levels of fraud throughout the entire industry. I highly suggest self-custodying any of the Bitcoin or crypto that you have. The second lesson is you trust, but you verify. So there's a lot of, and there have been for the past, 7 years, a lot of fly-by-night shops, a lot of folks that make claims and have fantastic decks and financial models, and then, the confirmatory due diligence on whether they can actually execute on that roadmap is lost because there's a ton of sizzle, but not that much stake within the organization. And so those two things, like self-custody your assets and then verify everything that you're told within the industry.
Yeah, I think those are two really good pieces of advice. And yeah, SBF did just get convicted. We'll see what his sentencing ends up being, but hopefully it's pretty extreme considering the circumstances in which he created. Were you affected by any of the FTX or Celsius, like on the personal side? Are you invested across these platforms, or are you a Bitcoin only kind of person?
Look, I'm a Bitcoin only kind of person when it comes to my investments. I have friends that were affected by FTX and were affected by Celsius, who I've kind of been like beating the drum for the last couple of years for them not to give away their Bitcoin for a 5 or 6% yield. I thought it was crazy back then. I think it's crazy now. But no, I wasn't affected personally.
Nice. Well, we're coming up on the end here, so my last question for you here will give you a chance to talk a little bit about Galaxy. You know, what is the future of Galaxy that you guys can share, and what are you guys going to be up to over the next 6 months?
Look, I think over the next 6 months, we are really putting the screws to optimizing the existing Helios facility and the East Texas facility from the mining perspective. We're doing a ton of work for our what we call our Phase 1A expansion. That's the 50 megawatts that'll come online end of this year, early next year. We'll see. It's going to be weather dependent. And then obviously what's on everybody's mind, we have the halving in April. And so really prepping as much as we can for that and retaining the optionality to, increase efficiency spreads and then hedge power where it's necessary and where it's like palatable on a forward basis. And understanding what the impacts are going to be in the downside scenarios to our existing mining operations.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that'd be a really interesting episode for Will to have with all the different operators of whatever. What does getting ready for halving mean for you? You know what I mean? I think both of us have been through two at this point, so this isn't anything new, you know, coming in. But I do think that is really the end all be all question right now amongst all the miners is what are you doing for halving?
Yeah,
So.
no, I look for from our perspective, like we're running different input assumptions into the model on, what does Bitcoin price look like? What does network hash rate look like? Are we gonna be at 600 exahash by April? Hopefully not. And then like what are the impacts to our like dollar per megawatt hour denominated gross revenue from the machines? How do we increase those spreads? What does the forward curve look like within Load Zone West? And then how do we effectively hedge and just like lock in profits like a true commodities-based business? And so I think taking a like very tactical strategic approach to like different possible scenarios and then determining like what are we actually going to do based on these scenarios and what are we going to implement from a software perspective to allow us to like free cash flow and maximize there is what we're currently going through. Yeah.
A question I have for you, mainly because I just don't know the answer. Are you guys, mining as a business or mining to get Bitcoin? Like, is there a HODL strategy, or do you pretty much sell daily to cover costs and lock in profits? Do you hedge? This is just, I'm just curious. Some miners, just sell, some HODL.
Look, I would say it varies. As we look at the mining business as a whole, we are within Galaxy to produce Bitcoin at the lowest marginal cost that we can. But at the end of the day, like Mike Novogratz, he really owns the Bitcoin risk of the firm. And so whether we sell, whether we hedge, whether we HODL, what percentage of those three different scenarios. That we do. That's really led by him as the figurehead and CEO of the business.
Yeah, and then final deal here. What is the exahash going to be at the end of the year? So 2016 block average. What is it going to be? 500 plus, 525, sub 500?
I mean, I somebody texted me the other day and said we briefly touched 500 exahash, and if you'd have asked me 3 or 4 years ago if we'd be at 500 exahash at the end of 2023, I probably would have fallen out of my seat. But I think at the end of the year we've got 60 days left. It wouldn't be impossible for us to see 525 or 530 exahash as like that last epoch kind of average at the end of the year.
No, I'm definitely expecting it to be up there. So should be an interesting close of business for the year. But yeah, we're coming up on an hour here, which wraps up our show. We just really want to say thank you for coming on, Austin. You're doing some amazing work over at Galaxy, and it was really interesting to hear some of the insights you've had and your experience in the mining industry. So thank you a lot for coming on, and hopefully we'll be able to catch up here in person soon.
Yeah, same. I appreciate it, Taylor. Mark, great to see you guys and catch up with you soon.
See you.